This is an ABC podcast.
At the end of the day, the APVMA are the independent national regulator, and whether we like it or not, we have to accept the independent umpire's decision, and we do that.
It's been called napalm for mice, but an application to use the poison bromodialone has been rejected. We get the latest from Western New South Wales. And later we hear how a family's negative experience with the National Disability Insurance Scheme is leaving them out of pocket.
I've done all this work with the correct wording of his needs and his what he needs and his goals and what we need to meet those goals and that. And the assessor said, you'll get what I tell you you can have and you'll be happy with that.
I'm Alex Hyman and this is Australia Wide. A toxic chemical described as being napalm for mice won't be able to be used to fight the mouse plague in New South Wales. In May, the state government made an application to use the controversial poison bromodialone for farmers and property owners to use for perimeter baiting. But its possible introduction has also come with growing concern around safety and environmental impact, and now it has been rejected for use by the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority. Lucy Thackray has become a mice plague correspondent of sorts over the last few months, and she's been following this decision. Lucy, what are the reasons for the bromodialone application being rejected by the APVMA?
So this application was put forward by the New South Wales Agriculture Minister, Adam Marshall, back in early May. And his reasoning was that it would be such a powerful chemical that it could be used by farmers to fight, you know, this worsening mouse plague. And it's explaining that, like you said, it's a napalm for mice. So that, in essence, is exactly why it has been rejected. So APVMA, they've had a look at all of the consequences and all of the implications of this poison, and there are concerns about what it would mean for other animals within the ecosystem if either they come into contact with that poison grain, which has been poisoned with bromodialone, or if they come into contact with mice that have died or have ingested that poison. Because what we do know about bromodialone, even though there hasn't been a lot of testing of using that chemical in perimeter baiting, but what we do know is that it's got a really high secondary killing rate, and that's something that environmentalists and farmers have been very concerned about since this announcement. So what that would mean if, you know, animals just came into contact with it in some way, one way or the other, and then we would potentially see birds, wildlife, pets, or even fish decimated.
So how has this news been received by farmers?
There's been a bit of a mixed response, but what has been surprising about this bromodialone announcement from the beginning way back in May was that most farmers said, I wouldn't use this on my property if it even was available, because they are so concerned about how potent it is, how toxic it is, and what that could potentially mean. There are others that are just at their wit's end with this, and they're saying, oh, I understand that there could be huge implications, but we need something, we need anything, because we're entering the 10th month of this mouse plague and it's absolutely showing no signs of easing. They're suffering damage to their properties, they've got mice running around their homes. So there are some people that are saying, I understand this could have impacts on the environment, but we just need something.
What has been the response from the New South Wales state government? Adam Marshall, the state agriculture minister, is having to respond to this after being caught up with the Sydney COVID outbreak. He has tested positive to COVID-19, is having to isolate at the moment, so he's got a bit on his plate.
Absolutely. So he has still been doing interviews on this decision from isolation, and he says that he's very, very disappointed. Not only is he disappointed, but he says farmers are disappointed. But of course, you have to respect the authority, and that there was, you know, the APVMA put this through some very, very strenuous investigations. But he does promise that the all eggs weren't just in that bromodialone basket, and there are other things in the works. So we do know that a doubly potent zinc phosphide, which is the chemical that's being used at the moment, has been approved. So scientists were testing and worked out that the poison that's being used by farmers around their crops, it could safely be doubled in toxicity, which will be great news for people when that does become available and easily accessed. And he says as well, scientists are working on looking at the biology of animals and for future mouse plagues, seeing if something can be created, whether that be helping to spread disease, which is what ultimately ends a mouse plague, or trying to stop mice from procreating in the future when we see this type of mouse activity start to ramp up again.
Let's hear from Adam Marshall, the New South Wales State Agriculture Minister.
I and a great many farmers out there are very disappointed with the APVMA's decision. We were holding out hope that this could be an additional tool that could farmers could access to, that were croppers, to undertake perimeter baiting to supplement the already existing double dosing zinc phosphide baiting that's occurring in crop. But look, at the end of the day, the APVMA are the independent national regulator, and whether we like it or not, we have to accept the independent umpire's decision, and we do that.
That was the New South Wales State Agriculture Minister, Adam Marshall, there, being interviewed from isolation, where he has tested positive to COVID-19 as a part of that COVID outbreak in Sydney. Lucy, you've been on this story since the plague began. Are things improving?
Yeah, unfortunately they're not. And it's pretty unbelievable that, you know, we're entering the 10th month of this situation and it's just not getting better. I mean, for mental health's sake, fortunately with winter, there's less of them running around like you would have seen earlier on. And that's because they go into their burrows or, you know, they're in the ceilings in houses or in haystacks because they're just so good at protecting themselves from the elements. So they're tucked away 60 centimetres underground, and even if it snows or even if it floods, like it did earlier in northwest New South Wales earlier on in autumn, they are protected. And so all the time we get asked, is this problem getting better with winter? But I've heard from farmers who've said even though they did testing and there was zero indication or evidence of any mice, and so they sowed their crops, those farmers, despite not seeing any for weeks and weeks, have already had 100% crop losses because they come out of their burrows or they come out of pasture paddocks where they're hiding with lots of food around. And then, you know, they eat these crops just as soon as they germinate. So it's really disappointing. And the biggest worry for people, as we'll hear from CSIRO mouse expert Steve Henry, is that if it's not nipped in the bud now, it's going to get so much worse when these mice start to procreate again in spring.
Breeding generally stops through the winter every year. And so we would be expecting that numbers will plateau over the next couple of months. We certainly wouldn't be expecting to see numbers continuing to climb unless conditions were really, really warm. We would be expecting numbers to plateau through the winter. And our focus is on understanding how many animals get through the winter, and they're the ones that could be causing trouble next spring if conditions are favourable.
That was Steve Henry from the CSIRO. Let's hope things do improve soon, as this has been a major issue now for some months. Lucy Thackray, thanks so much for speaking to Australia Wide.
Thank you very much.
This is ABC Australia Wide.
And you're with me, Alex Hyman. The National Disability Insurance Scheme has been in place since 2016 and now has around 450,000 participants across Australia. For many of them, it's been a godsend, giving people with disabilities and their carers access to therapy and support that had been completely out of their reach before. But for others, the support just hasn't been the same. Toowoomba mother Toni Mitchell spoke about her NDIS journey with David Ilafy.
I got a call from the assessor at the NDIS right at the end of the 3 month. It had been 3 months since I'd sent it all in. And she rang and she said, I've got all your stuff here, you need to explain it to me. And I explained it all to her and she said, I don't understand what you mean. And I said, well, if you go to the bottom of one of the bills and look at the graph. And she said, what's a graph? I was like, we are so screwed.
This is Toni Mitchell. Her son Joshua receives funding from the NDIS.
Joshua is a 21-year-old man. Mm-hmm. He has Down syndrome and autism, plus multiple other disabilities like hearing impairment and vision impairment. He also has a lot of complex medical conditions. So he has a couple of organs in failure, so he relies on different machines to help his body to function. In 2013, his body started to get quite bad, and it's just gotten progressively worse over the last few years. In 2016, he was diagnosed with early onset dementia. So that is progressing a lot now, quite quickly.
Wow.
The deterioration has sped up, so our needs are increasing exponentially as his health deteriorates.
So when Tony first heard whispers about this new scheme, the National Disability Insurance Scheme, she hoped it would be the answer to more funding for Joshy's therapy, a scheme that would recognise his multiple disabilities and fund therapies for each of them. But her hopes were short-lived.
They didn't show up for the first appointment. We sat here waiting, stressed, didn't show up. So a week later they came, we made another one, they came out and they sat here and they did the tick and flick where they do the assessment. Can you do this? Can you do that? No. Well, let's skip a few pages. And then they got to the end and they packed up. And I said, but I've got my list. I've done all this work with the correct wording of his needs and his what he needs and his goals and what we need to meet those goals and that. And the assessor said, you'll get what I tell you you can have and you'll be happy with that. And I thought, I've done all these seminars and all this work and all this planning, developing this because this is what everybody said we had to do and you're not even interested. And they were still packing up and I'm just sitting here crying. And he just stood there with everything packed up and he said, well, go on, tell me then. So I did and none of it went in. Yeah. And so our first plan was completely inadequate and it's just been downhill from there. Well, I did appeal. Well, yep. I rang up and I said, when I got our plan, I said, I need to lodge an appeal. And I was told, we don't do appeals. And I said, well, you must do something. She said, we don't have appeals. There's no appeals. And I said, well, if you get a plan and you're not happy with it, what do you do? And she said, well, you do a review of reviewable decision. And I said, so you appeal.
And when she opted to take her appeal all the way to the appeals tribunal, she found herself in a battle where the odds were grossly stacked against her.
Very, very stressful, because you're on your own. I can't afford a lawyer.
But you're about to go into you know, a completely foreign, hostile, competitive environment.
With,
you know,
against lawyers. Because
right.
The NDIS has their representative plus a lawyer plus her team. So I had to buy my own copy of the Act and the rules and everything so I could read it, highlight it, learn it, so I was prepared for whatever they might come up with.
Gosh.
So, yeah, I was spending my nights studying and right, isn't what we signed up for.
No.
We signed up for help, not to have to constantly be fighting. Honestly, we are so traumatised by this whole process that Joshy actually needs our bathroom renovated because he's so unsteady on his feet now. I'm not even trying to go down the NDIS path to get help with that because I can't deal with it.
But you can't afford to do that work yourself.
Well, I am looking at extending my mortgage to do that. But
yeah.
I can't deal with the stress the NDIS creates.
That's Toowoomba mother Tony Mitchell speaking to David Ilafy. Former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull is calling for a New South Wales parliamentary investigation into inadequate coal mine rehabilitation bonds. He's expressed concerns about the remediation conditions of the state's disused legacy mine sites. Mr. Turnbull says he believes the upper house would be the best place to allow for an independent review of how security deposits are calculated and the regulator's relationship with miners. Kelly Fuller has the story.
This week's New South Wales budget included $108 million over the next 10 years to remediate the state's disused legacy mine sites. Most of the mines targeted are between 50 and 100 years old, but Mr. Turnbull says the problem is more contemporary.
It's obvious that the remediation bonds are inadequate. The Australia Institute has estimated that they're inadequate to the tune of many, many billions of dollars. So the reality is that what is likely to end up happening the government does not increase the level of the bonds substantially, very substantially, is that when these mines finally do come to an end, and it may be an abrupt end, you'll have these enormous devastation in the landscape that ultimately the taxpayer will have to put the bill for, and that's just not right.
In New South Wales, a rehabilitation security bond must be paid by the mining company before exploration and production begin. The security deposit covers the full cost of all rehabilitation and mine closure. In the Illawarra, Lock-the-Gate Alliance has questioned the bond of $12.3 million calculated for Wollongong Coal's Russell Vale Colliery. The colliery's been in care and maintenance since 2015, and its owners, an Indian-based company, are $1 billion in debt. Last year, it received approval for an expansion.
What really worries us about the situation at Russell Vale is the sort of tail end of commitments that are remaining unfulfilled by a company that has been struggling financially for quite some years. It's good that the rehabilitation cost estimate has been increased, but that cost estimate doesn't necessarily cover, you know, future subsidence that might occur under the special areas of Sydney's drinking water catchment by geological events that happen, you know, after the mine site is relinquished.
The Alliance's New South Wales coordinator, Georgina Wood, says while there's been an attempt to improve the system, there remain concerns.
Still there is this sense in the community that there's going to be a really big job, not just to rehabilitate in the first instance, but to manage lands in the aftermath of mining. And a real great concern, which we think has some foundation, that there isn't really sufficient money and planning and oversight to ensure that the environment and the community don't suffer in the long term.
Mr Turnbull says he'd like to see the New South Wales Upper House take on the challenge.
And I think that the Legislative Council would be a good body to set up an independent inquiry into the mine remediation issue in New South Wales and just examine quantity surveyors and so forth in to look at some of these bonds, compare them to what the work would actually involve, and just really provide an independent audit.
He also sees the need for a long-term rehabilitation fund with perpetual money to fund jobs in the ongoing management and monitoring of post-mining landscapes.
If you're dealing with a very large, substantial Australian company, the bond is a sort of more by way of reassurance. But increasingly, the coal mining operations are being conducted by second, third tier companies, very often subsidiaries of foreign companies that will feel absolutely no obligation to do anything more than what the law absolutely obliges them to do. And they'll just won't have the money in the Australian subsidiary when the time comes.
So will the Legislative Council support an inquiry? Shooters, Fishers and Farmers MLC Mark Banasiak chairs the Upper House Committee that would have carriage of any review into the issue.
I would strongly suggest he draft up a set of terms of reference and write to the committee and suggest that we look into that. I would note that we do have several already inquiries on the go. One particular, the timber industry, which will probably take us into early next year.
In a statement, the Department of Regional New South Wales says mining projects are approved with rehabilitation conditions that must be met and the obligations are legally enforceable. They say security bonds have grown by about $1 billion to $3.3 billion over the last 5 years. They say it's extremely rare for the government to have to access a security bond.
Kelly Fuller with that story. ABC Australia-wide. It's now less than a month until skateboarding will feature for the first time at the Olympic Games in Tokyo. And while you may associate the sport with youth, Danny Monahan from Stawell in Western Victoria is proof that that's not always the case, becoming an accredited instructor at age 59. Danny is among the first to teach an older racing form of skateboarding called slalom in a course by Skate Australia and the Victorian Skateboarding Association. He told Andrew Kelso about what made him first get on board.
Danny Monahan is proof that age is just a number. The 59-year-old from Stawell in Western Victoria has been skateboarding competitively for more than 40 years, having started at a time when the sport was still relatively new.
It was pretty basic. The kids would roll around Central Park. Urethane wheels, the softer wheels, were just coming in, and there was a couple of kids in Stawell that could do these incredible tricks, a handstand or something like that, and just blown away. It just seemed like a good fun thing to do. BMX hadn't happened, so I went skateboarding.
Danny isn't slowing down and has just become the first new accredited instructor in his age bracket through a course run by Skate Australia and the Victorian Skateboard Association and is also the first in the course to teach slalom, an old style of skateboarding that involves racing around cones. He is also skilled with skating in a park and can do a handstand on a skateboard as good as the next person.
Most people that you see in your yoga class that can stand on one foot can usually do the sport. It's a little bit different because it's not just balance, it's balance while you're moving. So for some of us, it takes a little bit to get used to, but it's a skill most people can learn.
While you may think of skateboarding as an urban pursuit, there is a strong community of skaters outside capital cities.
People will travel to the good skate park in Horsham. They'll come up from Melbourne, or they'll go to Ararat, or they'll go up to Rainbow or something like that because they've heard of a skate park.
In about a month's time, skateboarding will make its debut at the Tokyo Olympics, something that Danny says will be good for the sport.
The Olympic thing is going to be quite good. It'll give skateboarding some credibility. And instead of people just looking and saying, oh, the kids at skate are sort of no-hopers, they're probably using something and stuff, it might make a lot of people second look at what kids are doing or what people are doing and look at the athleticism, and that it is a viable sport of some, you know, some note.
And there's every chance a future gold medalist could be in one of Danny's classes now.
Some people might look at a skateboard as being a fashion accessory and they think, oh, it looks cool to have one, but it's even cooler to ride it. It's fun. It's just something to add to your life, to give you something enjoyable to do.
Andrew Kelso with that story. And finally tonight, we head into a citrus orchard. Nearly 100 years ago, an orange tree was planted on the banks of the Burnett River near Gaindar in southeast Queensland. Walter Benham planted that tree in 1924, and four generations later, the legacy continues with a family partnership and around 70,000 citrus trees. Matt and Rachel Benham continue the family tradition, growing oranges, lemons, grapefruit and mandarins. Brad Marcellos met with Rachel at the Gaindar Citrus Orchard to find out how she fell in love and married a citrus man.
It is a lovely part of the world. We're surrounded by wildlife and a bit of livestock in the front paddocks, which is I like. And yeah, lots and lots and lots of trees.
What's it like being coming into a family that's fourth generation citrus farmers?
It's been a steep learning curve in terms of I knew nothing about citrus. Mm. So I always felt, I still feel like I'm a long way behind my husband and his parents, obviously. I just try to soak up everything from them.
Now, you have also started value adding by producing cordials, olive oil infused with citrus as well. Tell us about that and how you started doing that.
When I moved here, my grandma was a real homemaker and, you know, she was always the biggest support for all of our family. And she said, you need to make marmalade. I have no idea how to make it. Just have a go. So she sent me a few recipes. They were disasters. So I kept working with it and trying different varieties of fruit on the orchard. My first orange marmalade was awful. Then I got into the Murcott mandarins and created my own recipe and turned that into, well, we had it as wedding favours at our wedding. Added a few different things, a lime cordial, the marmalade, the jelly and a lemon curd. And a local family friend of Matt's who carts all our citrus had said, if you make this, I'll cart it for you for free. True to his word, my first load that, because everyone said, oh, you should sell it, you should sell it. It's just a little hobby of mine. I wanted something of my own because obviously I am far behind Matt and his parents with what I know in the citrus. So I've got something that's mine and I know what I'm doing. And so then I went into the marmalade and the jelly. So I found someone that does contract manufacturing and he developed a orange infused olive oil. And then I finally, when we got some lime trees, was able to do my lime cordial and went into mandarin cordial as well because Matt desperately wanted a mandarin cordial.
So let's talk a little bit about Matt too, because he loves his citrus, doesn't he? It's like an obsession almost.
It is. He lives and breathes it. So he's fourth generation. His parents are very passionate about what they do and so is he, which is probably how I've come to love this so much. Pretty hard not to love it when you're around them because it just, you know, I say that orange juice flows in their veins.
When you look around, you do, you know, it does look like a picture book. It's like something from a storybook around here. And with the trees, especially at the moment, full of fruit, it's absolutely stunning. You're fourth generation now, your kids. Do you hope this is a life that they go into when we do see so many families, you know, moving away from the family farms?
I think they'll want to. Part of me hopes they want to because I grew up on the land and I think I got my passion for the land from my dad. And I think being surrounded by it with us day in, day out, you know, they love to come to the shed. They love to get in the tractor with Dad. We have to go pick Mandy's every day. I think they will, but at the same time, if they don't want to be, I mean, it's getting tougher and tougher every year to be on the land, but you do it because you love it. But if they don't, that's also fine by us. We've got something here for them in the future, and if they don't want it, then that's okay too.
That's Rachel Benham, a citrus farmer from Gayndah, ending that story from Brad Marcellos. And that is Australia-wide for this Thursday night. I'll be back again tomorrow. I'm Alex Hyman. Have a wonderful evening. Cheerio.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.